Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, everybody. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and this is The Takeaway. In China, a public health crisis is continuing to grow. More than 20,000 people are estimated to be infected by the coronavirus, and nearly 500 deaths have resulted from the outbreak. In Hubei province, where the majority of infections have been detected, roughly 60 million people have been placed under lockdown. Sean Li, a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, has been under quarantine in Hubei province for 10 days now.
I think people are quite afraid here. So towards the end of last week, they've been doing regular temperature checks. And one morning we woke up, my colleague and I, and our temperatures were still within the normal range, but on the higher end of normal. So that got them very worried. So now we're restricted to our rooms. 4 more days until the quarantine is over, but we're still not allowed to leave the hotel, we've been told, even after the quarantine lifts.
For those like Sean who can't leave their rooms or homes at the moment, officials have been working to get supplies to people under lockdown.
We've been in touch with a local government official, and he said they've been busy arranging for vendors to send food to neighborhoods so people don't have to leave the house. And they're being very strict that if you don't have a purpose to be out on the streets, like delivery workers can still be out, you know, medical workers can still be out because they need to be. But anyone who doesn't have a real purpose to be out is not allowed to be out.
To get help to people who may be infected by the coronavirus, the Chinese government has scrambled to rapidly build 2 new hospitals in Wuhan, where the outbreak started. At least one of those hospitals will start taking in patients this week. But Sean says that health officials are still asking for more assistance.
You know, we're still hearing hospitals putting out public pleas for donations, for supplies, medical gear, protective suits, goggles. They still are undersupplied at this point.
And while the Chinese government initially underplayed the scale of the virus when the outbreak began, President Xi Jinping gave a speech this week indicating he's feeling pressure to get things under control.
It's a big test for China's system of governance. This is what he said. And I mean, it's true, right? However, if China can really handle the outbreak, then it would be a real success for China and its sort of authoritarian style of government. And if it can't, then it's going to be a huge challenge for Xi going forward.
Outside of China, cases of the coronavirus have been detected in at least 20 countries. And while the actual number of infections in those countries is relatively small, a wave of xenophobia and anti-Chinese sentiment has also emerged around the globe in response. For more on this, I'm joined by Sonia Shah. She's a science journalist and the author of a new article for Time magazine called The Pandemic of Xenophobia and Scapegoating. Hi, Sonia.
Hi.
What are the sort of xenophobic incidents that you've been noticing around the world because of this?
I mean, we see a lot on social media, of course. There was an incident in Australia where a man died of cardiac arrest on the street while bystanders reportedly refused to provide CPR to him because they were afraid that he was infected with coronavirus because this was outside of a restaurant in Chinatown. And, you know, and generally, I mean, what governments are doing too is targeting people based on their, you know, stamps on their passports, which is not what the WHO is recommending. Australia is detaining people who have been evacuated from China in the same immigration detention centers on remote islands where they've subjected asylum seekers to what UN observers and others have called cruel and inhumane treatment. And that's a very ostentatious way to treat these people. I mean, these are people who could be screened, who could be kept at home, who need medical care, and who also need to feel trust in public health advice and also doctors. I mean, if you think you're going to be subjected to coercive and extreme measures, if you tell your doctor you have a runny nose, then you're much less likely to do that. And that doesn't just endanger your health, it endangers everyone's health.
So do you think the response would be more pragmatic if the virus came from a predominantly white country like England or France?
Well, we saw, for example, with the outbreak of like mad cow's disease or H1N1, you know, when the source of the virus or the pathogen is associated with people who have social power, then we don't see this kind of over-the-top xenophobic responses. And, You know, so is it more rational? I mean, you would have to decide on a case-by-case basis because every pathogen is different and every epidemic unfolds differently. But we certainly can see these distinctions in the way we treat and name and characterize pathogens that come from far away in contrast to those that come from closer to home. I mean, you think about, for example, the fact that half of all cattle on American feedlots are infected with a very deadly form of E. coli. And because cattle waste infects our food and water so frequently, hundreds of thousands of Americans get sick from that every year. And that, you know, a lot of people, you know, you could imagine outsiders might think that that's really disgusting. But we don't describe it in the lurid terms that you see today being described, you know, that wet markets, for example, are being described in today. And that's considered the source of this novel coronavirus.
Historically, in terms of at least the U.S., there has often been a conflation between foreignness and disease, correct?
Yes. I mean, and we've seen over the past few years with the rise of right-wing populist leaders that, you know, this language associating foreigners with contamination and, you know, blaming them for all kinds of social ills, not just disease, but also crime, terror. You know, we've spent the last 5 years hearing political leaders, not just here in the U.S., but in Brazil and Philippines and Hungary, all over the world, telling us that all of our problems can be traced back to people on the move, immigrants and migrants and asylum seekers and all these populations on the move, these foreigners who are encroaching upon us with their contamination, whether it's cultural, economic, or now we see with health.
How much of this has to do with the fact that this is, when we look at, say, Wuhan, this is an area located in China, which has a government which is not transparent. How do we separate the fact that it is an authoritarian response to a disease that is, you know, coming from a culture that we've often racialized?
I mean, I think you're right. Like, it's true that there is a geography to our risk, right? So this virus actually did originate in a particular place. But being exposed to a virus in a particular place doesn't imprint itself on our racial characteristics or stamp itself on our passport. So it's overkill to then say, well, all of these people who are quote unquote Asian, who look Asian. I mean, this includes people who might be from Japan, who might be from China, who might be from Philippines, who might be Malaysian. You know, a huge swath of the global population might look like that. But, you know, meanwhile, Wuhan is a city that gets over 2 million overseas visitors a year. It's very likely that someone who doesn't look Asian is also infected. But if we focus only on how people look and what passports they hold, we're going to miss a lot of the true risk that is out there.
What are practical ways for someone to respond to this if they're scared about, you know, contracting this this virus?
Well, the WHO has made very clear recommendations. We need to do the same things that we do to protect ourselves from the flu. We need to wash our hands. We need to stay home when we're sick. We need to seek care if we feel like we're getting worse. So all of those things that work for other respiratory infections that we're very familiar with, like the seasonal flu, which kills hundreds of thousands of us every year, those same things will work with coronavirus.
Sonia Shah is a science journalist and the author of the upcoming book, The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. Sonia, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.